Welcome back to Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. John Hansen here on this Labor Day Saturday afternoon. Thanks so much for spending part of your three-day weekend with us. All right, my next guest is, I always love talking to Dean Vic Amar of the University of Illinois from the law school. You always make me smarter, Dean.
That's a nice thing to say, John. Thank you.
You don't sound like you believe me, but trust me, you absolutely do. And you make our listeners smarter, too. You know, you cover so many different things, obviously, at the University of Illinois, and your background is illustrious as well in the Supreme Court, working as a clerk, too. So I would hope that you could break down a few things for us. And I know the big story of the week, legally speaking, was what the Supreme Court first didn't do and then did do overnight Wednesday into Thursday, refusing, I guess, to hear the case of the abortion law in Texas. I just am curious, what sort of, you know, I'm used to the normal cycle, right? Like the justices hear cases in October and in the fall, we get cases resolved in the spring and summer. What is this? What are these emergency meetings? What are these quote unquote shadow dockets?
So the normal docket for the Supreme Court, as you point out, runs from October to June. And it involves cases that have already been heard by the lower courts. So they may have been heard by a trial court and then a court of appeals, in some instances by a state Supreme Court. And the loser in the most recent court below will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to consider granting review in the case. They do that by what's called filing a petition for a writ of certiorari, which takes several months. And the court usually takes several months to consider whether to grant review. It takes four of the nine justices to go ahead and grant review. And if review is granted, then the parties file briefs on the merits about why the lower court was right or wrong. The court hears a full-fledged oral argument and then takes several months after that to issue full-fledged opinions. Now, in addition to that normal docket, there's always a set of emergency questions that come to the court during the October to June cycle, but also during the summer. And these are cases that are not fully briefed by the Supreme Court, where there's not full-fledged oral argument, where the court doesn't take a long time to decide whether to grant review, and it doesn't take a long time to decide the case. They're decided on a much more truncated basis. Now, the quintessential example of something like this might be a request for a stay, right, or a blockage of a capital execution. That's something that if the court's going to step in, it has to step in right away, because if it doesn't, the person will already be executed and there'll be no more case. But increasingly, there's a lot more of these emergency applications to the court for the court to step in before the lower courts have really heard the case and to act very quickly and without a lot of process. Some people call this or parts of it the so-called shadow docket, because there's not full-fledged oral argument, there's not full briefing, there's not amicus briefs by all kinds of advocacy groups, and it's decided on a much quicker timeline. And a lot of people don't think that the process for deciding those cases is nearly as robust and is not as likely to generate deliberate, careful decision-making by the court. That's what we had.
Right. In this case,
this case fell into that category because the lower courts haven't really ruled on the merits of this case. And in fact, the lower courts decided not to rule on the merits right now, but to just let the Texas law go into effect and then hear challenges to this law later after it's applied against various abortion providers. And the abortion providers went to the Supreme Court and said, well, if the law gets put into effect, that's really bad for us. So you have to block it from going into effect in the meantime. And the court said, well, we don't think this is one of those things where we need to step in and interrupt the normal course of appellate review.
That was well summarized. Thank you. We did get the decision as like a 5-4 with Justice Roberts joining the liberal justices. For these shadow docket rulings, do we always get the who's on which side for it? Or is it sometimes just a written statement? Or is it sometimes just silence is your answer?
Yeah, you often don't get. What you'll get is a decision by the court, which means a majority thereof, to deny the request for emergency review. And then the question then becomes whether any of the people that would have granted review want to be on record to that effect and also the reasons why they would want to grant review. So you'll often have the dissenters weigh in to explain why they think a majority of the court was wrong not to step in, but you won't really have the reasoning of the majority often to explain why they didn't step in, although sometimes they will issue a short opinion explaining the decision to deny. Now, if they grant the unusual review, then they almost always, the majority thereof, will almost always explain why they're granting the review and what they're doing to try to preserve the status quo in the meanwhile. Now, remember, too, John, that Supreme Court does not, and this is really, really, really important, the Supreme Court typically does not decide cases to do justice to the parties. By that, I mean they're taking cases to issue statements of law that have broad ramifications, not to make sure that individual litigants are treated right. So the only reason ostensibly that they will step in the shadow docket cases is to preserve their opportunity to get at an issue that they think is of general importance and where time is of the essence, such that if they don't step in now, they're worried that something will happen that will prevent them from taking up the issue later in the normal course that we described earlier on the, you know, the full briefing and oral argument format. So the court's decision not to grant review doesn't mean that it agrees with what's going on. And it doesn't even mean that that the issue is not ultimately worthy of Supreme Court attention. What it means is the court doesn't think that there's anything particularly time sensitive about having to take the case now, because they think that later on the issue will come back and they can look at it later if they want to, recognizing that in the meanwhile, some parties may be hurt by the delay. The court's not there to really worry about the parties. The court's there to worry about the law and the formation of the law in the long run.
Interesting. So I know they already have a case that they are going to hear in this next upcoming term in out of Mississippi. I think it's a 15-week abortion ban. I don't know all the particulars. So someone had mentioned, I saw on one of the programs, that they could actually, in theory, roll this case into that. Is that done by someone actually suing and working their way through it? Or can they, on their own decision, kind of lump this in, this Texas decision, into the Mississippi law?
Well, there has to be some kind of a request before then, before they can do anything with the case.
Okay.
So they can't reach out and pull cases in. The court is a passive, not an active actor in that regard. But once the parties have put something before the court, and here they have, at least before yesterday, the court can always decide to consolidate that pending matter with another pending matter and resolve them at the same time or by means of the same set of opinions, et cetera. So my guess is in this case, the parties, the abortion providers, will probably come back to the court and ask them for some other kind of relief. And that'll be the hook that the court could possibly use to connect this case to the other case in which they've already granted review that poses important, albeit somewhat different, questions about the future of abortion protection under the Constitution.
Don't they know that we're in a 24-hour news cycle? We got Twitter now. We need answers quick.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because if there's one institution that is supposed to stand for everything that the 21st century unfortunately rejects, which is careful, deliberate, in-depth, balanced analysis, it's the Supreme Court.
Right.
And I think part of the problem is that there are so few institutions like that anywhere left. Everyone wants things quick and short. And the law is too complicated to resolve things really quickly and in a few words. And that's frustrating for people in this century. But it's really the problem of the mindset of the century, not the problem of the court.
Okay, fine. So you're telling me to get over it. I get it. No, I agree. Like, I do feel like in this rush of everyone wanting quick answers and to judge each other, right? I do appreciate that there is still an institution that takes its time. It is aggravating, especially for people who feel that this law is overreaching, or any law is overreaching and will harm them in the immediate. Of course, I'm not trying to make light of that, but that there is this deliberative body that does work through arguments slowly, I think should be reassuring to Americans, not a cause for blowing up the internet or canceling the Supreme Court.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I think the exhibit A for that, John, is what happened 20 years ago in the wake of the Bush-Gore presidential election. Now, there the court felt it had to act quickly because time was of the essence. But I think even people who supported George Bush and the legal position that he advanced, although I think it had some problems, I think everyone would realize or recognize that the opinions that the Supreme Court issued in the so-called Bush versus Gore case were much less careful and much less high quality than they might have been had the court had the normal time to think about and write its opinions. So something I tell my incoming law students every year, that in a world of Twitter where you have a limited number of characters, they have to approach the law very differently. The texts are the kind that you can't summarize in a few words, and you have to spend a lot of time wading through. And maybe I'm just an old stick in the mud, but that is reassuring to me, as you said.
You are not an old stick in the mud. I've got more questions for Dean Vic Amar of the University of Illinois Law School. After this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Back here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. So thrilled to be joined by the University of Illinois College of Law Dean, Dean Vic Amar. And Dean, I've already asked, there's no dumb questions. I know that's what we say, right? And I'm not saying that, people have dumb questions. What I'm saying is like, we all have something we wonder about the Supreme Court or other things. And I'm just so glad you're going to answer some of them. You okay to play our little game here?
My pleasure.
Okay. We kind of talked about in the last segment about how cases get to the Supreme Court. That was a question from the 847 area code. And they also asked about the fast track. So we've covered that already. Here's a question from the 630. Do justices talk to each other during the decision-making process, or do they not know the final answers until there's like some conference where they all get together and reveal on a piece of paper which way they went?
So it's a great question. And one of the reasons there are no dumb questions when it comes to the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court has gone out of its way in history to keep its processes somewhat behind the veil of ignorance from the general public. The court doesn't like to be too transparent. And I think there are upsides and downsides of that. But increasingly, there are more materials for people to understand the way the court operates. So basically, it's this. In the normal course of things, after the Supreme Court agrees to grant a case, as I said earlier, the parties file their briefs, and then there's an oral argument. Then after the oral argument, the justices will go into what's called conference. And with the benefit of the thought that they put into the case by reading the briefs, and then with the information they got from oral argument, they will take a tentative vote on how to resolve that case. So they'll go around the table, and each of them will lay out why they want to resolve the case in a particular fashion. Then from that, there is at least a provisional majority to decide the case in one direction. And the senior justice in the majority of that resolution gets to assign the opinion to one of the members of the majority. Now, the Chief Justice is always the most senior member of the court, notwithstanding how long he's been on the court. But if the Chief Justice is not in the majority, if the Chief Justice is one of the dissenters as they went around the table, then the person who's been on the court the longest is the senior member of the majority. That person will assign the opinion to one of the members of the majority. And then that person who got the writing assignment will work with her clerks and submit a draft opinion in the coming months. And then all the other members of the majority will decide whether they're comfortable joining on to that opinion or suggesting changes. Now, sometimes someone who's in the majority, after they read the draft opinion, says, I can no longer join that. And so I'm going to have to switch sides. Sometimes that means that the case comes out the other way if it was a 5-4 majority in the original conference. And meanwhile, people who are in the minority, they'll be circulating their dissenting opinions. And members of the majority, a minority, will be deciding which dissenting opinions they want to sign on to as well. And then once all of these opinions have circulated and everyone's joined what they want to join and asked whatever questions they want to ask, then the musical chair stops and the opinions are issued publicly. Now, to go specifically to the question you asked, most of the communication done by the justices is done by written memo and circulation of drafts. They do have a brief discussion after the oral argument in that conference I mentioned. But one of the things I was surprised by when I was a clerk for the Supreme Court, and it's been a few decades now, but I think the court still operates largely the same way, is that they don't tend to talk in the hallways or visit each other's chambers and chit-chat orally about the cases. They tend to communicate by written memo and circulating drafts. And that's a formality that the court has always operated by. I sometimes think that it would be a better institution if the justices did connect more in person and really hash things out and had
right.
had arguments. I will say that, remember, every justice has clerks who work for them. And the clerks do talk to each other from the various chambers. So even though the justices may not be engaged in a lot of face-to-face oral conversations, their surrogates often are, and they report back to their bosses. And so there is interaction between the chambers, but not as much as some people might expect or desire.
Interesting. So it's almost like a regular jury at first, where you kind of take a straw poll around where people are. But at that point, normal juries like can hash it out, right? And try and convince each other. Juries, but that doesn't happen.
Right. Juries don't write an opinion. Juries right. just talk about things and vote. What makes the Supreme Court distinctive in government is not that they decide things. It's that they have a very formal, time-honored method of explaining their decisions. So if you think about Congress, you think about the president, they do stuff every day, and they never really carefully in writing explain it. But the opinions of the Supreme Court are what make it special. They are what endure. They are what we academics talk about for decades and centuries beyond. And I think that's great, but I'm not sure that writing these terrific opinions is inconsistent with more informal deliberation before the opinions actually get crafted. But as I said, the convention is to really communicate with each other by memo.
Interesting stuff. This is so fascinating. This is like secrets of the Supreme Court. A look behind the gavel or underneath or whatever. I don't really know what I'm saying, but I do know that we got more quote unquote dumb questions for the Dean of the University of Illinois Law School, Vic Amar. We'll get to that here after this short break on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Welcome back to Let's Get Legal here on 720 WGN. All this powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Thanks so much for spending some of your Saturday Labor Day weekend here with us, getting a little bit smarter with the University of Illinois Dean Vic Amar. We've got some more dumb questions for him. But first, I do want to let everyone know in the next hour, we've got a great guest, employment law attorney Jeffrey Colwin. He does more than that, but he knows a lot about employment law. We're going to talk about vaccine requirements. We've been talking a lot about that, but I really want a legal perspective on that and on masks as well as about things you post on social media. Can you really get fired for that sort of thing? Any questions you have too, 312-981-7200. You know that's the number. Maybe text a few of them in right now. I can prep and get some more questions ready for Jeffrey Colwin. That's in the next hour. And we've got a 3-hour show today. It's a little bit of a bonus hour at 5 o'clock to 6. Normally we wrap up at 5. But Dahlia Saper is going to be here in the 5 o'clock hour. She's a social media expert attorney. And I'm really fascinated by some topical things that have to do with social media. TikTok is collecting our biometric data, apparently. Other social media accounts do that right now, but they're based here in the U.S. And, of course, TikTok based in China. That has some interesting ramifications. And we'll also be talking with Dahlia Saper about the fact that even though certain politicians and people have been banned from Facebook or from Twitter, the Taliban hasn't. And that's oddly very odd. I'll just leave it at that. Dahlia Saper will pick up where we left off. I got a couple other questions, Dean Vic Amar, if you're okay with that.
Sure.
How much influence does the Chief Justice have aside from, well, you mentioned earlier about how if they're in the majority, they can assign the majority case. But we often talk about like the Roberts Court and that sort of thing. Is there any other influence a Supreme Court justice has besides assigning who gets to write the opinion?
You know, that's the primary power that chief justices have to shape opinions by making writing assignments. The chief also has an administrative role where he oversees the court. He oversees the facility, the building, the office space, the resources of all the justices, et
cetera.
He's
an office manager, too. He does.
he has help, but he is. A lot of the chief's time is spent. You know, there are protests on the footsteps of the Supreme Court outside. He's got to deal with that. He's got to deal with funding of the judiciary and the Supreme Court. So he's the one who goes to Congress and testifies to explain why the court needs more money, or the federal judiciary needs more judges in the lower courts. He is the head of the entire federal judicial apparatus. But in practice, I think the Chief Justice's power to really shape the institution goes beyond these formal tasks that he performs. And it really relates to the historical tradition that attends the Chief Justice and the respect that people afford the Chief Justice because he is the first among equals. So I think John Roberts, for example, has a significant sway over some of the justices. For example, I think Brett Kavanaugh and Justice Amy Barrett are probably going to be influenced by the tone and the example that the chief sets. And I do think it is the Roberts Court, not just because he's the ideological fulcrum or center of the court, but also because he's just a very balanced, temperate, lawyerly person. That's part of why he was a good choice to make as a chief. You want as a chief someone who's not mercurial. I mean, you may love Antonin Scalia, but he doesn't have the temperament of a chief, whereas John Roberts does. And I think that chief-like temperament enables you to influence some of your colleagues in the way that, you know, as a dean or a chancellor of a university, I hope those of us in the administration can influence our colleagues.
Yeah. I know we've heard so many stories about Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, both passed, obviously, now being friends, despite being on way different sides of the ideological spectrum. Do the justices all get along?
Generally speaking, they do.
I hear something in your voice there.
Well, no, I think historically there have been some justices who might have some personal flashpoints with some other justices. But in the past 30 or 40 years, I think it's been a very collegial body. Even when you've had people like Clarence Thomas or Brett Kavanaugh come to the court after a very contentious confirmation process. Remember, right. Anita Hill for Clarence Thomas and Dr. Blasey Ford for Brett Kavanaugh. But once someone's on the court, I think the other justices realize, hey, this is a small group. We got to work with each other in close quarters for decades to come. Many decades to come in some instances. So they make a good effort to really separate the vehement disagreements they might have over law and case resolution on the one hand from the personal integrity and intelligence that each of them brings to the task. So I think they do get along okay. I don't know that there are that many of them that are super, super close friends with each other. Occasionally right. That happens. As you mentioned, Scalia and Ginsburg, I think Chief Justice Rehnquist was friendly with Bill Brennan and others. And I know that, you know, Justices Marshall and Brennan were close to each other. So there are some close friendships, but I would liken it to a law faculty, a well-functioning law faculty. You have some groups of people who are really close personally, and if things are going right, everyone gets along pretty well, even if not everybody is buddy-buddy with everybody else.
I liken it to a close radio station, Vic.
There you go. That may be true, too.
Yeah, I have so many other questions, but Vic, I've already taken up too much of your time. Dean Amara, the University of Illinois Law School. I hope you'll do this again. We got a lot of more questions coming in we don't have time for, but I really appreciate your time.
Anytime you'd like, I'd be happy to continue the conversation. Thank you so much for having me, John.
Yeah, it's so fascinating getting a peek behind the robe, the curtain. I don't know what to say, behind the Supreme Court. We'll just end it at that.